The clerk will call the document.
Larry Lee Williams against the Commonwealth of Virginia, Jesus Christ, Pope the Third, City Council, our Mayor and Attorney General, Virginia Beach Heights, and Senior Assistant Attorney General for the Appalachians.
You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am Pratt Coach on behalf of Larry Williams. This is a very unique case. It was the uniqueness of the case. And if I may reserve 7 minutes for rebuttal.
Seven?
Yes, sir.
All right.
Thank you. It was brought on by an agreement by the counsel, Commonwealth Attorney, and Defense Counsel, where Mr. Williams would plead guilty to a crime and also not guilty by reason of insanity to two other crimes. It's unique in the sense that there was one sentencing hearing dealing with both matters, and the trial judge had before it a pre-sentence report, two independent custody evaluations, brief testimony of the victim, a victim who read her impact statement, and argument of counsel. Normally in a criminal matter, criminal sentencing, the court generally will have the pre-sentence report before it. It will have a narrative of the offense. It would have the prior record of the defendant. It would have some history, if there is any, of mental and physical impairment or health conditions or prior treatment. It would have family background, sentencing guidelines, and sometimes a victim impact statement. In the instant case, however, since there was also two charges that were being disposed of by NGRI, not guilty by reason of insanity, there were also two independent custody evaluations from independent experts who determined that Mr. Williams had mood and personality disorders. And one of the doctors determined that Mr. Williams was a danger to others, and the other doctor determined that Mr. Williams was a danger to himself and others. As far as argument of counsel at the sentencing hearing, Commonwealth insisted on a 5-year sentence. That's what the sentencing guidelines proposed. And Williams argued that he should be committed to the hospital because the reports that were done by the two independent doctors had recommended hospitalization at the present time due to his mood, personality disorders. And he also had a cannabis disorder as well. Counsel argued on behalf of Mr. Williams that punishing Mr. Williams by placing him in prison would be like punishing him for his mental illness. The trial judge acknowledged that he had the reports before him. He knew, he indicated that he understood Mr. Williams' need for help, but yet regardless sentenced him to 5 years in prison, followed by a commitment to the hospital.
But the 5 years in prison was for the July 8th conduct.
That is
for
correct.
Which he pled guilty and for which he was not found guilty by reason of insanity and for which his guilty plea implied his sane status at the time.
That is correct. And so if we look at the two microcosms and we have the criminal case on one side and the civil case on the other, certainly the 5 years is within the range, and normally this court will not disturb a sentence like that that's within the range. However, if you look at the whole picture, the court had before it recommendations from two doctors that indicated that this man needs to go to the hospital because of his disorders. And that's where Mr. Williams asserts the error was committed.
Are there not mental health programs available in the prisons?
There are mental health programs that are available in the prisons, but the recommendation was for hospitalization. Hospitalization, obviously, I believe, is like Central State, for example, is suited for people of this very disorder, and that's what these experts recommend. They didn't recommend that he be in a mental health unit in a prison. They recommended that he have hospitalization at the present time.
Why couldn't the hospitalization take place under the DOC?
Because it's not truly hospitalization. These mental health units are the best they could do is the way I can put it. If you open up the newspaper in the past 12 months, you'll see cases of mentally ill people who unfortunately have passed away or have physical ailments that have passed away in the prison system. And that's what this case is trying to prevent.
So you're talking about the quality of the care.
Quality of the
DOC.
Care. And there's also no indication that Mr. Williams is part of one of those mental health units in prisons that he's been in. In my brief, I indicated that he'd been at Greensville.
But isn't that a separate issue? I mean, because once he's committed to DOC, don't they have the obligation to make sure he gets whatever health care he needs, whether it's mental health care or physical health care?
Well, I would say that they do have an obligation to do that. Whether or not they meet that obligation is another matter. There is one prison, Marion, that deals with the acute mentally ill, and he's not there. If you do a record check now on where he is, he just recently was moved to Keene Mountain, and he's never been with the acute mentally ill at Marion. And that's where the problem lies. That's why he asserts there was a violation and an error in his sentencing, because the reports were clear that he should be in the hospital.
How could that be a violation in his sentencing? Why wouldn't that just be a violation in his classification or a mistake in his classification in the Department of Corrections if he's not sent to the right facility?
Well, I believe that before the trial court, during the sentencing hearing, he had these two independent reports before him, and he knew what these doctors were recommending. And when I think of due process rights, I think of fundamental fairness. And Mr. Williams' argument is that it was not fundamentally fair for him to be placed in prison when the trial judge knew of his medical conditions, his mental health conditions, and the recommendations of the doctors to be in the hospital. So I don't believe it's a classification issue. I believe it's a constitutional
issue. Except for the fact he pled guilty to a felony that carried this sentence. And at the time he pled guilty, he conceded he was not suffering from any sort of insanity or lack of capacity. And his position, his condition is not chronic. It's never been alleged to be chronic. He was sane on July 8th, but allegedly unsane on August 24th.
Yes, Justice. He's not complaining that he received the 5 years. He's complaining of the way he has to serve it. So he's complaining that he should have been allowed to remain in the hospital, because what makes this even worse in his mind is that he was already in the hospital the day of sentencing. He was at Central State. The records are clear there. So he was moved from the hospital to prison for 5 years, and then he would, you know, under this current order, he would have to go back to the hospital for commitment once he served that 5 years. So the argument is that here you have someone who has this mental illness and is a danger to himself and to others placed in prison. So what his argument is he's asking the court to remand it for resentencing, having this court state that there was a violation of his due process rights, and to resentence him in that regard, so the court hopefully would commit him to the hospital.
But under your scenario, what punishment does he receive for pleading guilty to a felony that occurred on July 8th?
Certainly he could receive the 5-year sentence on the tail end of the after he has the hospital commitment. Certainly.
Did you make that argument to the trial court?
I did not make that argument. The argument was not made to the trial court in that regard. The argument was, Judge, please put him in, commit him now to the hospital. He needs the services of the hospital. He's mentally ill. And if you put him in prison, you're punishing him because he is mentally ill. And his record is terrible, and prison has not helped him. It's one of the worst records I've ever seen. And the court, unfortunately, decided to put him in prison despite that.
You're down to about 6 minutes.
If I reserve the remainder?
Yes.
For rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, Virginia Tyson for the Commonwealth. The defendant in this case did fail to alert the circuit court of the arguments that he is making on appeal, namely that as a matter of law, the court had no choice but to send him to Central State prior to or instead of prison. The ends of justice do not apply here. This court should apply the rule and find that this allegation is defaulted. And the reason that the ends of justice should not apply is that there was no error, and even the purported error did not constitute a grave injustice. The NGRI acquittee statutes do not explicitly cover the factual situation that we have here, which is one finding of not guilty by reason of insanity for a particular offense, and a competent defendant who pled guilty and was validly sentenced as authorized by law.
Doesn't 19-2-182-3 require a court to commit an NGRI acquittee?
Your Honor, that is one of the options that the court has under 19-2-182.3. The court considers the many factors. A petitioner can be released with conditions, can be released without conditions, can be committed to a behavioral department of behavior.
The reports from the medical personnel indicated that he was in need of hospitalization. 19-2 provides at the conclusion of the hearing the court shall commit the acquittee if it finds that he has mental illness or intellectual disability. So this court decided that after the 5 years, this gentleman then could be committed. So it would seem that he did find there was a mental illness or intellectual disability. Why isn't that shall mandatory, that you shall commit him?
Your Honor, I believe the reason that it's not mandatory under this circumstance is that this statute does not cover everything that was before the trial judge. Had this defendant been an NGRI acquittee only and nothing else had happened, then this statute would cover the entire scenario before the trial court. But that's not what was before the trial court in this case.
Counsel, I'm parsing this statute. In addition to that, let's repeat that sentence. At the conclusion of the hearing, the court shall commit the acquittee if it finds he has mental illness or intellectual disability and is in need of inpatient hospitalization, period. That includes a definitional sentence. And then it says, the decision of the court shall be based upon consideration of the following factors. It lists four of them, the fourth of which is such other factors as the court deems relevant. That, as I parse it, such other factors as the court deems relevant is related to whether the court finds that he is in need of inpatient hospitalization. Because that the court shall commit the acquittee if he is in need of inpatient hospitalization. And then it says, look at the following things to determine whether he is in need of that. The disconnect here is that the court determined he was in need of hospitalization and then decided to defer it for 5 years. How can that deferral be permitted under a statute? Your argument has to be, well, the court determined he is in need of hospitalization, but somehow the court determined that it is that his need can be deferred for years into the future.
Your Honor, my response to that would be, although number four, such other factors as the court may deem relevant, I would suggest that another factor the court may deem relevant is that you have a competent defendant who has also pled guilty to a felony charge, and the court has a duty to sentence that defendant on the other charge, unrelated to the not guilty by reason of insanity.
They have a duty to sentence him, but it's not mandatory that they sentence him. But the NGRI is you shall commit him if he is under this disability.
Your Honor, I think that the reason the statute cannot be interpreted that way is because of what could result if that were to happen. And I think we made some reference to this in our brief, but the argument of the defendant and the reading of the statute that no other options can be considered when we have someone who has pled not guilty by reason of insanity and has also competently pled guilty to a crime that carries a prison sentence, is that once hospitalization is required, no matter what this defendant does from that day forward, he will never be able to be punished at the Department of Corrections. The only thing that can happen to him is that he will remain committed at a behavioral Department of Behavioral Health facility.
Not for the first offense, not for the July 8th offense. You're arguing that if he's committed for the August 24th offense, that precluded the trial court from having him serve his sentence on the July 8th offense after he's restored?
No, Your Honor, I probably wasn't clear. What I'm saying is no matter what he does in the future, if he were at Central State and stabbed one of the employees at Central State, well, these doctors have said that he needs inpatient hospitalization, and under the defendant's argument, he couldn't be sent to the Department of Corrections for even that offense, for which he was not NGRI.
But under a commitment is indeterminate, is it not?
It is reviewed, but yes, Your Honor, it is.
So if at the time he were to stab someone while at Central State, at whatever time it is determined that he is competent, he could then serve the sentence for that hypothetical offense, could he not?
Your Honor, I think under the defense argument is that once you are not guilty by reason of insanity, and the finding is made that you need in hospitalization treatment, that that's the only thing that can happen to you.
And you're saying the appellant's counsel will have the opportunity to respond to this. You're saying that the defendant's argument is if he is committed first for an indeterminate period at Central State, and the court then enters an order saying he will be committed for an indeterminate period at Central State and subsequently will serve his 5 years consecutively after he is released from Central State. The appellant's argument is that cannot happen?
No, I believe that is his argument. I believe that is his argument, and obviously he can speak.
And are you saying that can't happen, that that's impossible?
I'm saying that it's not as a matter of law mandated that it must happen in the order in which the defense argues that it must happen. And the reason that I argue that...
Is the statute ambiguous? You and I seem to have a disagreement about how to interpret it. Is that because there's an ambiguity?
I believe it's because the statute doesn't address the full set of facts that were before the trial court in this case.
Would that then be an ambiguity?
It would be inadequate to address everything that was before the trial court.
Trying to reconcile competing statutes, one that just doesn't speak to this situation.
Yes, yes, sir.
And so you have column A and column B, and how do you make them fit together? And the statute applies strictly to column A. Well, now we have column A and B.
Yes.
Can I ask you a question about we're looking at the legal findings of NGRI and a guilty plea. What about factually? Was the evidence factually undisputed that he was in desperate need of this mental health treatment, that he was insane, and so on? Or was there a conflict that might illumine the court's action?
Well, Your Honor, two prongs to your question, and I'll answer in kind. There was no dispute by the doctors who did the evaluation. He was in temporary custody. He was not a patient at Central State at this time. He was in temporary custody. There's no dispute that each one of those doctors found that he was in need of treatment. As far as the insanity, not guilty by reason of insanity, the record indicates, the record shows clearly, the prosecutor considered this a mistake. He agreed to the NGRI finding before he had access to Dr. Nelson's evaluation, which found that actually the defendant was not insane. Essentially, he was a malingerer. He sent a letter to her after the evaluation that said, well, I was really guilty of everything. So as far as the not guilty by reason of insanity, there was an agreement that the prosecutor made, and he was stuck with that agreement, and he stood by the agreement, but did inform the court that the defendant, according to the evaluation of Dr. Nelson, was not insane at the time of the offense. And I think it's also important as a factual matter, Your Honor, that at the sentencing hearing, the argument the assistant commonwealth's attorney made to the court was that actually the preference of having the defendant serve the prison sentence first, followed by the commitment, was beneficial to both the victim, because the wife is always the victim of every crime the defendant commits. And with his time, the 5 years in prison, there's protection for that victim. In addition to that, if he served was committed after that, it actually would help in the return of the defendant to the community and to society because, as under these statutes, the defendant could be released with conditions. And so in making his way back into society, he could be released with conditions, and that would be of assistance not only to the victim but also to the defendant.
Could he not be released with conditions under a scenario where he is sent to Central State first and then to prison afterwards?
I'm not aware of that, Your Honor, that one could be released from a prison sentence with conditions. Obviously, there's the possibility for probation, but he didn't receive probation. He got a 5-year sentence, and that was it. So my answer, I think, needs to be no to that. But another point that I really think is very important.
Are you certain of that answer? Or
no, I'm not certain of that answer. I'm thinking that he has no probation, and he would not be on parole. He had a 5-year sentence, and that's the basis of my answer.
Ms. Tyson, it seems to me that if we follow the appellant's view, that as soon as you're not guilty by reason of insanity, you have to be committed. That if you had somebody who's already in prison for an offense, who commits a new offense, and is found not guilty by reason of insanity, he gets a free pass out of the prison and goes back to Central State. That, it seems troubling to me.
Yes, sir. And I think that's similar to the free pass that we were anticipating, that if he's at Central State and is an NGRI acquittee, he gets a free pass from serving time for the crimes he commits at that point as well.
This is the bottom line. The NGRI statute obviously just does not contemplate a scenario like this. It doesn't address it through ambiguity. It doesn't address it through the text. And thus, it's a matter of discretion for the trial judge.
Yes, Your Honor, and this trial judge did not abuse that discretion. And I would point out that although the trial judge did not go on and on about the treatment that was available in the Department of Corrections, he recognized that this person could receive help while he was incarcerated. And although the operating procedures from the Department of Corrections provide for assessment for treatment, and the facility at Marion, as is available for anyone to find on their website, is for the acute treatment of mental health issues. It is a treatment
facility. He wasn't sentenced to Marion, was he? He's not serving time at Marion.
He is not, Your Honor. And under the Department of Corrections procedures, he must be assessed for his mental health needs. And I believe that counsel made some reference to this, that if in fact he is not receiving the mental health treatment that he needs to have while he's in the Department of Corrections, there are mechanisms for him to challenge that, whether it's through an informal complaint, a grievance process, a 1983 action. And so the Department of Corrections has a responsibility, and if they do not meet that responsibility, there are ways for...
He was sentenced to the DOC, not to any particular penitentiary. Am I right?
Yes, that's
right. So it's the DOC's call as to where to send him based upon the medical evidence.
That is correct. After the assessment, then there is a review process there as well. So while he is in the Department of Corrections, it is not a situation where he cannot receive treatment. He is obviously not out in society at that time. He is in custody, and he may receive mental health treatment. And then, following his release from the Department of Corrections, there is the commitment to Central State, and however long that happens, he can then be released with conditions for his benefit and for the benefit of the victim in this case. So presented with these options that the trial judge had, the trial judge did not err, did not abuse its discretion, but in fact fashioned an appropriate disposition, which included a criminal sentence and a commitment. And because the trial court did not err, this court should not apply the ends of justice exception. And in fact, the judgment from the Circuit Court of the City of Richmond should be affirmed. Unless there are additional questions.
I have a question for you. Do you have any thoughts on whether or not what the trial court did might be considered a conditional release under 19.2-182.7?
The condition of the release is that he served the time first.
Right, because in the prison system he would be able to get the help that he needs. They talk about inpatient and outpatient, and I assume in the NGR statute they talk about outpatient being anywhere other than, Central State. But there are other places one could be in a hospital other than that.
Yes, and I don't know that the trial court thought of that, but certainly that was a choice that the trial judge had, given everything that was before him for this in this case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal.
Yes, thank you. One thing that was mentioned were the 5-year reviews. If His case is sent back for resentencing, and he's committed now and would have to serve his prison sentence later. He would have the benefit of five-year reviews where he'd go back to court annually, and they would check on his status and how he's doing. It was, say, year four of the review, and the court and the experts decide that he can be released conditionally. I believe at that point in time, the court could send him to DOC if it deemed appropriate to do so, and that would be the way to essentially do both sentences, dispositions of the case.
Let me ask you the question that I asked Ms. Tyson. Tell me if I'm wrong about this. Your position is that once you're adjudicated not guilty by reason of insanity, you must be sent to a mental hospital.
I believe so.
All right, so if a prisoner is in Red Onion and doing a sentence, a dangerous prisoner, dangerous enough to be in Red Onion, and commits another crime, and is found not guilty by reason of insanity of a crime committed in prison, then your position would be he had to be taken out of prison and put into Central State Hospital.
Well, he already has the sentence that the court has given him, presumably, I guess, a life sentence to give him at Red Onion, so that's a very complicated scenario, of course.
But it's consistent with your position.
I understand
your position is that as soon as you are adjudicated not guilty by reason of insanity, you must be sent to a mental hospital.
The mental hospitals, i.e. Central State, they're like prisons in that.
Well, they may very well be,
they
but
are
they're
structured.
They're not like Red Onion, I'll tell you that.
There's no other place on earth like Red Onion.
That's right. And they're just questions of security, et cetera. I just find it hard to be workable with your position if that's a possible result of it.
Well, I think this situation is distinguishable because it's a five-year sentence, and because of the nature of the offenses, he's not going to be at a place like Red Onion.
Yeah, but we're not able to make that distinction. So let's follow on that question with this one. You've got somebody who's been convicted of a capital offense and is sentenced to death for that capital offense. As instead of the factual scenario you have, and then, but after committing the capital offense, before being arrested, he is also arrested for a second offense and is found not guilty by reason of insanity. So, in other words, I've taken your exact factual pattern and have just changed it from an assault and battery to a capital offense. You would have to make the same argument that
well,
he has to be sent to Central State, even though he is subject to a capital offense.
Well, he is obviously mentally ill. He's found to be not guilty by reason of insanity, and he would have a report. If they assume there was an agreement, like in this case, that would show that. And I think he should have to go to the hospital to be treated for his mental illness.
Even though we can assume that Central State perhaps is not capable of holding a capital offender?
I don't know if they are or not, but if we assume that they are not, that would be a very complicating, very complicated for the Central State to have to deal with.
Second question. And this follows on my the colloquy I had with Ms. Tyson. Is it your position that he once sentenced to an indeterminate, once committed for an indeterminate period of Central State, that he could not thereafter serve 5 years in the prison system for the first offense?
I think that if the court orders at a sense in hearing that he's to be committed to Central State, and upon his release from Central State, he's to be transported to the Department of Corrections. I think that certainly can be done.
But I thought your argument was that he should get credit for the time he spends in Central State against his five-year sentence.
That is an alternate argument that would be presented to the trial court if it was sent back for resentencing. as a proposal to let him serve his sentence while he's at the hospital. There is a statute that allows credit.
So you're saying it wouldn't automatically happen? It would have to be something.
This court, I guess, could order that. We've asked this court to order that, but if this court didn't want to go far enough to order that, that would be brought up at the sentencing hearing.
Was the trial judge ever given those options?
Excuse me?
The trial judge was never given those options.
He was not.
So to establish manifest injustice, you obviously first have to establish it's an injustice, which means convince the court an error occurred. But secondly, it's not enough to convince us that error occurred. It's got to be manifest. That means obvious, plain. Nobody could disagree reasonably.
I understand that. And so the error that he asserts is the due process violation that I've argued. And the court's also pointed out that what the statute for commitment says, that he shall go to the hospital. Assuming that's what the error is, then the grave injustice is you have a mentally ill person who's going to serve 5 years in prison.
But my thinking is you've assumed away the qualifier. You said there's an error, and the error is really bad. But it's got to be a manifest error. In other words, it can't be a jump ball. It can't be an inference piled upon an inference from some statutory phrase. It's got to be clear. It's got to be indisputable. Something that a trial judge would know and should know, even if nobody mentions it to him.
I think it is clear, because a mentally ill person is in prison.
Well, counsel, there are mentally ill individuals who are in prison, and there are programs. I'm not going to argue how effective or ineffective they are. Did either of the mental health professionals, was either of the mental health professionals presented with the option of him receiving mental health treatment while in prison? So in other words, this is speaking to the manifest nature.
They did not testify at the sentencing hearing, so the answer is no.
All right, your time has expired. Thank you for your
Thank
argument.
You. Thank
Call
you.
The next case.